I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello everyone, today's episode is with Adam Hay-Nichols, a hugely charismatic journalist that spent around 10 years in the F1 paddock before taking a break. He's actually back in it soon as he'll be heading out for the Dutch Grand Prix and possibly Austin later in the year too. He started his career around the same time as me, 2005, and for those who have been around the sport long enough, you might remember the Red Bulletin magazine, which appeared on coffee tables up and down the paddock. Much of that was Adam's doing. He joined us from his home remotely. We tend not to do face-to-face interviews so much at the moment, but it's something I do want to get back into. And we spoke about his life in journalism. He told us the motivation behind his new book, the Charles Leclerc biography, which you can buy everywhere. He painstakingly researched and wrote that all by himself. We also talk about his near miss with a Russian missile. He's just returned from driving an ambulance to the front line in Ukraine. Fair play to him for that, something many of us have probably thought about, but few have acted upon. I hope you all enjoy hearing from Adam. And before we start, a massive thank you as always to our show sponsor, Paul Oz. Head to pauloz.com to see his amazing works of art. We've actually just given away one of his Senna paintings, an original, to a lucky competition winner on social media. Well, we're trying to give it away. We've emailed you, Joanne. Please email us back. If we don't hear from you, we'll have to move on to somebody else. Right, enough of this. Let's head over and hear from Adam. Enjoy the show. Adam, great to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us. Now, our paths have crossed a few times over the years, although we've never really got to know one another properly until we had a chat recently at the Williams Racing, the Gulf Oil event, which led to this, incidentally. But we go back. Our paths do cross. And my start in Formula One was 2005 when I was working with Toyota Panasonic Racing with Richard Cregan and Budansky Sponsorship Limited, and then went on to do a few bits and pieces with Kingfisher and Vijay Mallya and his famous yacht parties. And you were around at this point, weren't you? You were often on those yacht parties, right?
Yeah, that was very much the golden years, I think, of parties, or at least, you know, posts of 1970s parties. It was a good time to be around. I started in 2005 as well, with Red Bull. I was making a magazine for them. I was a staff writer on a magazine called the Red Bulletin, which was a really cool magazine. It was quite irreverent, and it was published, believe it or not, four times a weekend. We covered all sorts of gossip around the paddock and features and things like that. I was sort of their news hound, and I was also, you know, kind of the party reporter as well, I suppose, in some ways. So, I was at all of those yacht parties. I was out every night. I honestly don't know how I did it. I couldn't do it now. I mean, I was out until sort of 2-3 in the morning, and then I'd have to be back at the track at 7 a.m. I mean, it was ridiculous, really.
And those yacht parties were mental. I don't remember it terribly well either. They were quite messy evenings, and there was a lot of interesting people on those boats. Just paint a picture for us of what those parties look like, because they don't happen anymore. Those sorts of parties, I mean, I know we have yacht parties and stuff at places like Abu Dhabi and Monaco, but those Vijay Mallya parties were something else, weren't they? Just paint a picture for us what it was like to be on one of those boats.
Well, so the boat was called the Indian Empress. As I recall, it was 95 meters long, which is big. And they basically, VJ and Force India invited everyone, like everybody in the paddock. I mean, quite a lot of the time with these parties, you know, it's a guest list thing and it's, you know, sometimes a bit tricky to get an invite, whatever. They literally invited 2,500 people. And you got had everybody on it, you know, everybody from the paddock and, you know, usually, you know, a sort of harem of pretty girls. And you'd always have to, I mean, it's with yachts, you always have to take your shoes off, right? And inevitably somebody would break a glass. And so inevitably you ended up with glass in your feet. And I remember finding myself covered in Flavio Briatore's blood because he stepped in a glass and was padding around the place. I mean, it was very strange. And then, you know, the sorts of people that you get on it were just bizarre. You know, I mean, I remember being sort of by the bar with Cliff Richard and I think Philip Green. And then Bollywood's answer to Natalie Portman. I mean, it was just a very strange setup, but great fun. And I was always the last to leave.
Gone are those days, I think. At least I'm not invited to any of that stuff. Yeah. No one goes to the races anymore. It's all remote. And I definitely think Vijay Mallya doesn't go to all that many races anymore. That is... No.
He goes anywhere anymore.
That is... It's like another life, almost, in terms of, you know, the way you look at Formula One on a grand scheme of things. Because, I mean, I know there are still, especially Monaco, places like that. You know, they do have the boat parties and they have the yachts and Miami with the fake harbour and all of that. But it doesn't seem prevalent anymore. Maybe it's just being hidden a bit.
Well,
but
it's always been hidden. It's always been hidden. I mean, the thing is that, you know, I mean, I've written pieces before about, you know, I did a piece once about basically the theme of the article was do Formula One drivers have as much sex now as they did in the 70s? And the answer is yes. And the parties are pretty wild, but it's all behind closed doors and you don't really get to see it. And I mean, I don't know. I haven't really been around the paddock so much in the last few years. And obviously Formula One's got much bigger in terms of the audience. Now, whether it's got any sort of more, because I mean, you know, it's very corporate, right? But, you know, it can still be pretty wild. So, I imagine it sort of still goes on. I mean, it's quite weird, you know. I mean, as we said, you know, like if the Me Too thing ever, you know, catches up with Formula One, and I'm surprised it hasn't, then, you know, a few people are in for, you know, a bit of trouble. But, you know, when the Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell and all the rest of it. And the woman who, well, the girl who was, you know, has accused Prince Andrew of, you know, lying and all the rest of it. I mean, she was on one of these yachts. There are pictures of her on this yacht with Eddie Jordan and Flavio Briatore. And I'm amazed that it's never caught up with Formula One. But there you go.
Well, I think there's another podcast in this somewhere, isn't there?
Probably is. Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, and I mean, I don't know. I don't really know. I want to be the one to break the story, but I mean, my goodness, you know, some stuff went on, and yeah, there you go.
I mean, I want to delve into that, but I also don't want to delve into that.
Well, we should probably consult the lawyers first.
Yes, I would say so. Yeah. In which case, while we consult the lawyers, before we dive into it though, what are you doing sort of at the moment? What the day to day? How would you sort of describe what you do to somebody who didn't know what you did?
Yeah. So I mean, I'm a journalist. I just write. You know, I don't do podcasts. I don't do TV. I'm just a writer and a freelancer and. I've been a lifelong fan of Formula One and, you know, desperately wanted to work in Formula One as a teenager and was very focused on that. And I was in the paddock for 10 years. But, you know, I have other interests as well. And I've also, I'm massively into road cars. And I sort of made a decision, you know, around like sort of 2015 or something to slightly pivot and still do my column in the Metro, but go to fewer races and do more reviews of fancy cars. So I do that as well, and I do a few other things. You know, I do quite a lot of luxury travel writing and adventure type stuff. And then I just got back from Ukraine, where I was driving an ambulance to the front line for a couple of features, for one for Rolling Stone magazine, one for Airmail.
Wow.
Which was a bit different, but really actually amazing experience. I absolutely loved it. And I feel very privileged, actually, to have had the chance to go and see what's happening behind there. So I'm still quite buzzing from that, to be honest.
I bet, yeah. So talk us through that a little bit. I mean, we spoke a couple of weeks ago when we were trying to arrange a date for this, and you said, yeah, we'd love to come on. I've just got the small matter of popping across to the Ukraine to sort out, you know, pretty casually. You went there, you...
Well, I told a few people before I went so that I was basically committing myself and then I couldn't sort of pull out. So I thought, yeah, if I tell a few people, then there's no pulling out of it. I have to go. So I did. It was absolutely amazing. It was so cool.
You have to go. What was it like? How can you describe that experience of going to the front line, seeing it all happening with your own eyes? I mean, it must have been a fairly life-changing experience in a way.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing from sort of the beginning was, you know, I flew to Poland and, you know, it was all done by these sort of encrypted apps. Because, you know, the Russians might be tracking you. So, you know, I met up with this chap that I never met before called Sergey, and and he sorted out me out with this ambulance, and off I drove 1,000 miles across Ukraine. And then when I got there, yeah, I mean,
How did you get there? Like, did you take a flight to Poland or and then drive?
Yeah, so I flew Ryanair to a place called I can never pronounce this right, Zhuzhou. That's not how it's spelled, but that apparently is how it's pronounced, which is the closest airport to the Ukrainian border because you can't fly to Ukraine because it's just the military. Anyway, so basically I got there. I got a cab to the border. I walked across the border and there was Sergey and he gave me the keys to this ambulance and off I drove.
Wow.
And
are you on your own at this point? So Sergey's passed you the keys. Is he like, right, here's a map, off your trot.
No, so basically Sergey sat in the passenger seat to Kyiv, and then I stayed the night in Kyiv in a hotel that was Egyptian themed. Like imagine Abu Simbel meets 40 Towers. Very strange. And and then Sergey arrived the next morning with another ambulance. These ambulances are cool, right? They're Toyota Land Cruisers, like 80s spec, but new. And they have the passenger treatment bay in the back and all the rest of it, bull bars, winch, huge tires, massive shock absorbers. And he and I and another contact of mine out there drove three ambulances 100 miles an hour, all these miles to the front line, where we sort of basically stayed in a field hospital and watched as they did surgery on, you know, really, really badly injured soldiers. It was incredible.
What are the scenes like in Kyiv and the places you drove through Ukraine? You know, is it all a bomb site?
No. So basically, so where the front line is, which is always changing, obviously. So I think like the artillery range is about 20 miles, but obviously they can send cruise missiles much, much, much further. So around the sort of front line, it's pretty serious and you've got clouds of, clouds from explosives going off and all the rest of it. Everybody's wearing, flak jackets, pretty much everybody's in fatigues. But then when you go about an hour behind the front line to some of the cities, Zaporizhia and Dnipro, which were two of the ones that I was in, life is completely normal. Yes, there are apartment buildings that have been blown up, but everything's open. You know, I went to this amazing restaurant. I had the most fantastic eel tartare and a lovely Ukrainian Chardonnay. It was delicious. Ooh. It's all going on. It's all absolutely completely normal. But also, you go to the supermarket, everything's in the supermarket, including bulletproof jackets. And I went into one and I was invited, there was a T-shirt with Vladimir Putin's face on it, and I was invited to wipe my boots on it. You know? It's pretty amazing what's going on. But, I mean, they are tough, brave, determined, and they're getting on with life as normally as they can. But it's going to be a long war, you know, and it's been going on for 18 months already.
Adam, what was the motivation for going out there?
I think it's just one of those things that I think it was an itch I sort of needed to scratch and that I wanted to go to a war zone and sort of see it with my own eyes, and particularly this war, which is a war that the likes of which we haven't seen for a long time because you've got, you know, two sides with very modern weaponry. You know, a similar mindset. But I wanted an adventure, really. And this opportunity came up, which I thought was a, a good opportunity to do something a bit different, meet some interesting people, write about it for some interesting publications, and you know, hopefully shine a little bit of a light on some of the things that are going on there, because I don't think the organization which I went out with, they haven't really been covered yet, and they're very interesting. So so that's, yeah, that's why I did it. The organization was called MOAS. It's a humanitarian organization.
Okay, well, we'll chat the links to that in the podcast description. I mean, fair play to you. I mean, not an easy thing to do, you know, scary. So, you know, well done. Very, very impressive. One thing that we did want to touch on, you know, outside of your writing in the Metro and all the other things that you do, you've also written a book, the Charles Leclerc biography. I guess, again, what's the motivation for the book, and why that driver in particular?
So I've written quite a few books. I don't know how many, 7 or 8 coffee table books, and they've all been mostly pictures. So this was the first book that I've done, which is basically all words, which was a challenge, and I really enjoyed doing it. A lot of research went into it. And the reason I decided to tell Charles' story, apart from the fact that he's a very talented racing driver, and obviously, you know, racing for Ferrari brings a certain, you know, romance and glamour to all that, you know. I think part of the reason that I wanted to do it is because he's a bit different to some other drivers. A lot of drivers arrive in Formula One basically having no hardship. I mean, there are a handful of drivers who get there on the basis of completely their own talent and don't come from money, Lewis Hamilton being an example, Sebastian Vettel being an example as well, and Kimi Raikkonen. But Charles has actually experienced hardship in the form of the fact that his father died when he was young. Jules Bianchi was his best friend, and his godfather died, you know, from injuries that he sustained at the Japanese Grand Prix 2014. So he's had that sort of unusual grounding. I think that his he has this inner steel that's been forged in grief. And you remember when he won his first Grand Prix in 2019 at the Belgian Grand Prix, and that was the day after his very good friend Antoine Hubert had been killed. To, you know, go out, respond in that way and drive the race of his life and win his first race was a hell of a sporting achievement. So I sort of sat up and took notice, I think, really at that point. I thought, this kid's a bit different, you know. He's a gentleman. He's sort of quite old school in that regard, I think. But he has this toughness, which I think is rare. He's not a spoiled kid like some of them. This kid is a bit of a tough nut. And I suppose in some ways I identified with him because my father died when I was young, and I felt that we had a sort of connection in that way. And so I thought, well, maybe I'm the man to tell this story.
I remember, was it 2017 for Charles in Baku, and he won the race the day after, or the week of, I believe it was, that his father died, and just sort of that, you're right, that inner steel is such a good way of describing what you can develop from that.
Yeah, it was about 4 days after his father died, and you know, yeah. I just think it's so, you know, not many people could do that. He takes these sort of, because he's very emotional. I mean, he's composed, but he can be very emotional. We've seen a number of occasions, and you know, he takes this raw emotion, and with sort of furious alchemy, you can turn it into speed.
Do you think Charles is living the career of what Jules would have gone on to do?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. That seat was the plan, and yes, he has, and I think that he feels that. But it's not a weight on his shoulders. He sort of feeds off it. I think that's a big part of his motivation.
I mean, it's a powerful story. You're quite right. And actually, on the face of it, you know, you wouldn't actually straight away think he hasn't got to Formula One without any hardship. But then all you have to do is peel back that one layer, and you actually do see all of those things. And you're quite right. I mean, you've had experience with it. I mean, I'm sure if you haven't had an experience with grief, then you're very lucky. Everyone goes through it at some stage. I lost my mum when I was 21 years old, so sort of I kind of know sort of the rough of it, and how that can sort of form your mindset and change your mindset. I suppose what's the plan with the book? Is there a plan? Is it you know, how can we get it? Where is it? How can we buy it?
Well, very easy. I think it's on sale most places. It's definitely on Amazon. It's in real actual bookshops.
Just Google
as well.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, it's in real actual bookshops as well. I know it's in Smiths and Waterstones and Blackwell's and that sort of thing. So pretty easy to get hold of. Just Google Charles Leclerc, Adam Hay Nichols, a biography.
Do you think he needs to leave Ferrari?
Do I think he needs to leave Ferrari?
If he wants to win a world championship.
Yeah. I don't know that that's necessarily a good idea. I would wait it out because he's in potentially a really good position at Ferrari if they can get it together. He's sort of the chosen one there, and they love him. Even though he's only 25, he has extraordinary leadership abilities, and that's why they talk about him in the same breath as Ascari and Lauda and Schumacher and people like that. And I wouldn't be in a hurry to leave just because he's been there for four seasons, and in two of those years he's had a Duff car. But I would ride it out, and I would I think he should stick around to see what 2026 brings when they bring in the new engine regs, and let Fred Vasseur establish himself there, because it takes several years, obviously, when a new team principal comes in to get their new hires in and all the rest of it, which is very much what Otmar's been saying last week about why Alpine were wrong to get rid of him, and he's right. So you need to give a new team principal, I think, at least four seasons. And Charles and Fred are very, very close. They're almost like father and son. They've been together since karting, when he was racing for ART in karting. And I think that Charles is very loyal to him. I don't see him walking out the door anytime soon. Unless, what are the options? He goes to Mercedes, who aren't any faster at the moment. Nobody underestimates them, but there's no guarantee there's going to be a better car. Best car, obviously, is the Red Bull, but would it be a good career move for him to be in Verstappen's team, which it very much is? I'm not so sure. So I think Ferrari is the best option. But the onus is, it's going to require a lot of hard work, and he's up for that.
A very short interruption to this conversation with Adam, just to remind you about Paul Oz, our show sponsor. Head to pauloz.com and have a look at his work. You can see him all over social media. He's done some of the most important and incredible Formula One related sculptures and paintings of recent time. He's just released a sculpture.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Of James Hunt, which I was lucky enough to see down at the MTC, the McLaren Technology Center, recently. It's beautiful stuff, but you can buy his paintings and his sculptures now. Have a look at pauloz.com. We've actually just given away one of his Senna original paintings through a competition we ran on social media. I'm sure we'll be doing more of those. Go and have a look. Massive, massive thanks to Paul. Honestly, without the help of sponsors, this show just wouldn't happen. It wouldn't exist. It's so, so important that we have partners like Paul supporting us, helping us to keep going. Thank you, Paul. Right, back to Adam. Let's hear a little bit about his cars. Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, Adam, you're a man who likes a nice car. Mm. You're lucky enough to have driven several nice cars. What are you cruising around in at the moment? I sort of picture you in a Rolls Royce, like a drop top Rolls Royce or something along those lines.
Well, not far off. I mean, my car, my daily driver, is a Bentley Continental R, with a hard top, which I think is much more rakish. So yeah, you're on the right lines. It's a proper old school gentleman's express. My car's 1997, but it definitely has a 70s heart. and a 1950s engine. But it's bloody good.
What was your first car?
A Peugeot 205. What was my second car? A Bentley Continental R. I like that.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot.
Oh my god! So that is a ridiculous transition. A Peugeot 205 to a Bentley. I mean, that's what goals. The hell are you going to go that to after this? Goals. How do you improve?
I should explain that in between, I lived in Paris for about 10 years, and in Paris, you really don't want to own a car because either somebody will take the bumpers off it, or worse, they'll set fire to it. So I just rode the metro, anyway, I'm in London now. I mean, it's a city car to own. I park it on the street. You know, I get done for you, Les. But it is, it's well worth it. It's bloody exceptional. Love that car.
What, I suppose you obviously drive a lot of cars anyway in your job. What's the best car and what's the worst car you've driven?
Well, so in terms of the best cars that I've driven, I've driven pretty much all the Ferraris, and I've always had a soft spot for the F12. That was good. The new 296 is also really, really good. I mean, the Ferraris are all good. And then I love classic cars, and I recently did the Mille Miglia in a 1954 300 SL Gullwing.
Oh.
God, that was brilliant. Loved it. And I also drove Tim Birkin's 1929 teen car number 2 Bentley blower. That was magical. I loved that. And then in terms of worst cars, even the worst cars are pretty interesting. I mean, I recently drove a Fisker Ocean, which is an electric SUV, which is very good in some ways, but absolutely narcoleptic to drive. I mean, I nearly fell asleep at the wheel so many times. they asked me afterwards, so how was it? They asked me afterwards, the engineers, so how did you find it? And I described it as soporific. And they looked at me and said, do you mean that? And I'm like, yeah. But I didn't add anything else. So they weren't really sure if it was a criticism or not. Maybe they just thought, I thought it was really comfortable.
I'm in that camp. I've got an Audi e-tron, an electric SUV, which it's very, very comfortable, very nice to drive. But you're right, you could easily fall asleep at the wheel with the the slight boring nature of these kinds of vehicles. But but its performance is good. I mean, it's quick for a 2.5 ton car. It really shifts. It's not slow, but.
But they're like light switches. Your Bentley you go down, whiz you go. But then obviously it's got a huge amount of weight, and then the corners are just boring.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll tell you what the most fun electric car or electric vehicle I've driven is by far. So you know the Light Car Company, who make these brilliantly detailed. I think they're 75% scale cars. They did a Type
3. Oh yeah, Jackson. Yeah.
They did the Aston Martin DB5 convertible. They did Ferrari Testarossa, like the 1950s one. And I went up to Bicester Heritage recently to have a look around, and I drove them all. And my God, they are so much fun. And yes, they're very expensive toys, but they're not really for children. And I absolutely loved it. Yeah, they are really, really cool. And they just announced that they're bringing out, because I do like my pre-war Bentleys, they're bringing out a 4.5 liter blower, 80% scale, 85% scale, 85% scale, I think. So this thing is huge. I mean, it's the size of a regular car, right? And unlike all the other ones, it's going to be road legal. So you can drive, it's like the perfect pub car, isn't it? So I am all set to go and drive this car. It's going to be absolutely fantastic. I can't wait.
That's awesome.
I mean, it costs probably as much as a Porsche 911, but cool, right?
You know a lot about cars. Harry and I think it's safe to say we don't know an awful lot, do we? We're not car experts. We know most, but I mean,
speak
you drive
for
a Qashqai.
Speak for yourself.
You do drive the world's most boring car.
No, I'm sorry, it was car of the year. Nothing wrong with a Qashqai. Thank you very much. Nothing, especially when you didn't pay for it.
Fair. I want Adam to critique my cars. So I've had over the years the best car I've ever had. I'm not a car man, but I did enjoy this. So I had two cars that I really liked. One was, I had a Clio Cup 172, a 2001 version, and I had a 2004 facelift Honda S2000, which my mates absolutely ridiculed me for, but I thought was a really cool car. They were like, "It's a hairdresser's car. What are you doing prancing around in that?" What do you make of those two choices?
I think they're both very, very good choices. I mean, also the thing with the Honda S2000 is, like, usually Japanese cars date very quickly, and that car still looks fresh, you know, like quarter of a century later. Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Yeah, that's a very, very cool car. And I think it was also like the first car that I can remember, or certainly the first affordable car that actually had a red start button. And also like the cabin, you remember, it was very, very minimal and driver focused. Yeah, that was a really cool car.
And
the Clio as well. I mean, you know, that was when the French built proper hot hatches. Lovely cars.
Do you want to review Harry's Qashqai?
Well, I had a Ford Fiesta before that as well. So both very good cars.
Oh, what kind of Fiesta? What year was the Fiesta?
It was brand new. When did I get it? I got it when I was in school, sixth form. So that was 2015. Ford Fiesta in red, 1.2.
Now, if you turned around and said I had a 1982 Fiesta, I would have had enormous respect for that. I drove a Mark 1 Fiesta recently that actually belongs to Ford. Like, they have a heritage collection. And I took it out. It was the color of a hearing aid. And it was the most fantastic car. I absolutely loved it. 1.1, you know, as light as a feather. Fantastic fun to drive. And also, because my great aunt Margaret had one, and it had that very distinct smell from the exhaust, and it was like stepping back in time 30 years. But yeah, I loved that car. That was really great. But, you know, I mean, actually, so Fiesta's, like, the last ST was really good. That was a great car. I like
Fiesta. It's a shame they're canning them, I think. It's a real shame.
Yeah, it's a huge shame. It's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I don't know, just getting rid of these names, but then, you know, but then they got all right.
It's the Puma, isn't it?
Cortina and all the rest. Well, the Puma's come back as an SUV, hasn't it?
Yeah. I thought that was what they were sort of half replacing the Fiesta.
I liked
the
90s one, you know, with the Steve McQueen ad. That was cool. Yeah, you remember when they ripped off Bullet? It was really clever at the time. That was one of the most high-budget adverts that had been made in 1997 or whatever it was.
Well, clearly Ford coming back into Formula One has meant some things have had to be sacrificed, and clearly the Fiesta is one of those things.
They made a wrong decision there, haven't they?
But I mean, you mentioned at the start, you know, with Leclerc and wanting to stick around with Ferrari till 2026. What do you make of the current landscape in Formula One and the future that holds for it? Obviously, it's a bit Max Verstappen dominated at the moment, but we've had domination before and we'll probably have it again.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that we're living in a golden era where he's just, you know, he's the most dominant driver and the most dominant team that we've ever seen, and we should savor that. And probably in a decade, we probably will look at that in the same way that we look back at the Schumacher era at Ferrari. But I do find it a bit boring at the moment. I also think there are too many races because, you know, you want to build anticipation, and I think, you know, about 18 races a year is about right. And I actually quite like the sprints and everything, but, you know, again, there's an argument that it's just sort of all a bit too much. So I'd rather sort of fewer races, and obviously we want to see, you know, multiple drivers and ideally two or three teams fighting for the championship. Let's see what happens. I mean, the thing is that we all thought it might close up a bit this year, and the opposite has happened.
Pretty good.
You've got to take Max out of the equation. Just get rid of Verstappen, and you've actually got a really competitive championship. It's just him ruining things up front. You just got to look from second back, and you're laughing.
Yeah, I think David Croft was saying the other day something that I thought was quite savvy, which was you know, that that Perez sort of ruined himself, sort of Miami-ish time when he was within about 6 points of Max, and he started to think, I could win this championship. And then he got absolutely ruined. And that's why his whole mentality has been broken. But there are, you're quite right. There are some interesting things happening down the pit lane. McLaren coming back, that's great. And I really hope that Aston Martin can sort of find some of the form that they had at the start of the season, because if nothing else this year, I want to see Alonso win a 33rd Grand Prix.
God, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Adam, what does the motorsport, or particularly the journalistic aspect of motorsport, what does that landscape look like for you at the moment? Presumably, you know, since 2005, since you started in this game, Formula One has moved on, but the whole media and social media and journalistic world has changed. How have you coped with that? Do you mind the way journalism has gone? There seems to be writers everywhere now, you know, whether it be on social media or on websites or, you know, in the press. How have you adapted to that? Do you like the way it's going?
I mean, I've adapted in terms of, you know, doing broader things and doing different things. I mean, to be honest, I although I have my column in the Metro and I still go to the odd race and things, I sort of found after a decade of being in the paddock and covering F1 that everybody was basically doing the same thing, writing the same thing, covering the same stuff, and the paddock wasn't really open to doing things that were a bit different. I mean, I did over a decade ago now, about 2011 or 12, I bought Vogue magazine to a race with a crew, and we shot the cover on 34 pages. So I coordinated and produced the shoot, and the results were absolutely spectacular. But at the time, the paddock, which of course was, you know, it was owned by Bernie at the time, and nobody was very, very keen on reaching new audiences like that and doing something a bit different. I'm sure that if I tried to do it now, it'd be very different, and they'd welcome me with open arms. But I literally had to put my balls on the line to get 8 passes for a supermodel and a photographer and a bunch of assistants. I mean, it wasn't easy to do. So I suppose in some ways it's good that the paddocks have opened up a bit, and you know, they are reaching new audiences and they're getting a bit more creative. I mean, I think for some of the old school lot in the print press, it's probably a bit of a. I mean, I think they're basically being eased out, to be honest with you. But you know, I mean, the originality pays. You know, I mean, I don't really see the point of doing the same thing as everybody else. So if you can come in and, you know, come at something with a new angle, you know, that's great. And also, you know, Formula One has always taken itself way too seriously. And if the media can, or new media can come in and, you know, pop that bubble a little bit, that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Now, we'll let you get on with your day shortly, but we do have a final 3 questions, which we ask all of our guests. And this week they're brought to us by our show sponsor, Mr. Paul Oz. Head to pauloz.com to check out his amazing art and sculptures. They're absolutely stunning. We've actually just given away one of his center paintings. There's probably more to come, so keep an eye on our socials for that. Harry, why don't you kick off with number 1?
Yep. What's got you excited at the moment?
Probably that war in Ukraine that I just got back from. I mean, it was amazing. It was an absolute adrenaline rush. You know, as crazy as that sounds, I don't want to come across as some kind of, you know, like war junkie, but it was a almost life-changing experience, really. And yeah, that got the blood flowing. Yeah. I mean, terrible things are going on there, but what a privilege to be there and see it and meet the people involved. So that definitely got me excited.
Did you have any close calls while you were out there? I mean, did you see, I know you weren't there for too long, what, a week or so?
Yeah, I did, as it happens. So I went to this place just behind the front line, and the night before I got there, a missile destroyed a school about a mile from where I was staying. And then, so the following evening when I was there, I was with some medics having a barbecue, and the air raid sirens went off, and they go off all the time. I mean, nobody really pays attention to them anymore. And then there was this almighty bang, and everybody sprinted into the basement, and just sort of stared at the walls for a while and waited for the all clear. And I later found out that it had been a Russian missile, but it had been intercepted. So the big bang was it being taken out of the sky. But yeah, I think that's probably the closest that I've been. I mean, it was about a mile away. I think that's probably the closest I've been to getting a missile in the face.
Oof, it's close enough. Yeah. You don't want it to get any more intimate than that, do you? second question for you, how much of your success do you put down to luck and right place, right time, and how much do you put down to sheer hard work and graft?
Well, success is definitely a relative thing, but I certainly had some fun experiences and some, you know, interesting access and opportunities and to go places and meet people and do things. And, you know, I've been fortunate in that way. But, I mean, I don't know that it's been that in terms of, you know, luck. I think it's probably Yeah, hard work. Or, you know, I mean, just, you sort of charm your way into these things. I wouldn't call it bullshitting. You can sort of charm your way into certain opportunities. And things. But, Formula One, for example, is a very it's a very nepotistic business. And I didn't know anybody when I first decided that I wanted to work in Formula One, which was, I guess it was about 14 or 15. I still have files of rejection letters from F1 teams and all the rest of it, who weren't interested because they didn't know who I was. So, and it was actually, originally I was going to go into public relations. That's what my degree's in. But I ended up going into journalism because I just found with writing that it was a bit more honest. It was less bullshit. And it was, you can write a piece and you can say, this is what I've done. Do you like it? And if people like it, then, you get to, make a living out of it.
Yeah. Cut out the bullshit. Happier life, for sure. Final question. What are you scared of?
Being keel-hauled. Don't ask why. I don't know. Okay. I'm not really scared of many things, but for whatever reason, I've always...
Well, hang on. What the hell is that? Being...
So it's basically... It's a punishment that they used to exact in sort of... a long time ago. Pirates and bearers and that sort of thing, but basically they would sort of tie a rope to your hands and your legs, and they would drag you along the sort of barnacle-strewn hull of a
Game of Thrones style.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, you end up at the end of it. You've either drowned or you've had your back completely cut up and full of salt and not very pleasant. So for whatever reason, I've always thought, keel hauling would be probably the worst way to go.
Well, if you don't pay your ULEZ, then you better be careful because that could happen.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I would personally like to keel haul Sadiq Khan, but there you go.
That is single-handedly the best answer we've had to that question. So thank you for not saying spiders. Very good. Now, Adam, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
No, I don't care. Actually, I'll tell you where I was because I was covering Extreme E during the first couple of seasons of that. Great fun. Loved Extreme E. And I mainly liked it because of the locations. Went to amazing, adventurous locations like Greenland and Senegal. And I came back to my hotel room one night in Uruguay to find an enormous tarantula. It was bigger than a baby. Ooh. And the thing was, I just drunk a bottle of wine. So I was actually pretty relaxed about the whole thing. And I basically just literally kicked out the door. Yeah, it was fine.
No. You are getting the bottle and smashing it with the bottle then.
Well, the bottle had already been taken care of and destroyed, let's say. I kicked it. Yeah, just kicked it out the door. No problem.
What a hero.
Ooh. Oh,
yeah.
I could
leave a dent in your shoe.
like a football.
There you go. Ping. Oh, dear. Adam, absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us. Lots of fun and some great insights and some nice memories from back in the good old days of Formula One when, the yacht parties were a little bit different to how they are now. But long may your success continue. I'm sure we'll see you in a paddock soon. But for now, Adam Hay-Nichols, thank you for joining us on the Motormouth podcast.
Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth_, Instagram at Motormouth_official, and Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out how you can help cure brain tumors quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.